It's
1:15. I just celebrated my birthday. You know, Facebook is an incredible thing because in one way, it's like, okay, it takes you like a minute. No, it takes you less than a minute. It takes you a few seconds to express, you know, the birthday wish on there. It doesn't require very much thought, effort, because you get the update, and then all you have to do is plug in a couple of words. You know, on the other hand, you don't have to do that. I mean, so, and then some people do, right? And I mean, even if you don't, it is nice. I keep going back and forth about it. I guess where, you know, I'm at the point now where I'm just feeling like, hey, if you didn't like me, or if you thought I was some sort of bastard, you wouldn't bother in the first place. So therefore, on a collective level, thank you everybody for your nice gestures, really, from my heart. And I'm so lucky that I have this platform to say that, you know? So thank you. And for those who happen to spend my birthday with me, over my friends over at Brick, and the friends, my documentary friends afterward who I ran into, and my companion, and everybody else, thank you so much. What a wonderful day it was. Okay, Wildlike, episode number 314. This is a terrific film. I was at the Woodstock Film Festival last year and was lucky enough to see this movie, directed by a first-time feature filmmaker named Frank Hall Green. And Frank has this incredible story, personal story and professional. And he put together this film, and who stars in it but one of my favorite actors of all time, Bruce Greenwood. Do you know who this guy is? If you don't, first of all, if you think you don't, and you're into film, and you're into, you know, independent film, you do know who he is. And if you're a Hollywood film buff, you know who he is, because he's done a lot of mainstream big-budget films as well, but he's primarily done smaller films. What a great actor, and what a great person. So I meet Frank Hall Green. We had a great conversation, and he tells me this story about his getting mugged in New York City. I'm not going to tell you much more because I want him to tell you. I want this to come from him and his account. It's an incredible, remarkable story. So we're going to go into that conversation first. And then he's going to talk to you. We're going to talk, of course, about, you know, filmmaking and the making of Wildlike. And then we're going to talk to the lead actor in the film, again, Bruce Greenwood. So yeah, it's a doubleheader. These were recorded up in Woodstock, New York, last year, just at this time. And so I want to thank everybody over at the New York Film Festival. Now, kids, today I recorded an interview with Adam McGoyan, who is a Canadian, much like Bruce Greenwood. In fact, Bruce, if you are a fan of Adam McGoyan's, you know he has been in several Adam McGoyan films, including Exotica, including The Sweet Hereafter. So you know about that. We're going to play on the next episode. Adam McGoyan will be on the show. I'm very excited about that. So Bruce Greenwood, Frank Hall Green on this episode, Adam McGoyan on the next episode, plus more treats for you. Let's get into this show a little faster. I've just spent a long day. It's late. I got to go to work. So we're going to go right into this. Now, I will say this much. Bruce Greenwood plays a bit of a loner. He's basically ends up feeling responsible for and attached to a young girl who is running away from a unfortunate, intolerable situation with some family members where she's living. And she runs off and meets this character played by Bruce Greenwood, and they form an unlikely but wonderful bond. It's a very, I don't know, simple, straightforward film. It's definitely character-driven. It's really refreshing. You know, you see a lot of these films, but this one just sort of was a little bit more exceptional and fulfilling than the average. So I want to recommend to you right now, you can go and see Wildlike, And I would heartily, unequivocally recommend the film. My conversation now with Frank Hall Green, and then I'm not going to even enter. I'm not going to even like interrupt. We'll go from Frank Hall Green into my conversation with the great, great Bruce Greenwood. Thank you, both of you guys, for being on Film Wax Radio. And then I'll come out back afterwards and talk to you then. Okay, here we go. Wildlike, now in theaters.
Can't believe how much you've grown up.
Look at you.
Well, I imagine all the guys would be chasing you.
It's Mackenzie. I'm calling for my mom.
She checked herself out.
Are you, like, in some kind of trouble or something?
Have you got a fire schedule I can look at? 11 a.m. to Seattle. Is that where you're from?
That's where I live.
I'm going to hike through the park for a few days.
Hey!
Frank Hall Green?
Frank Hall Green.
Oh, good. I'm glad I got it.
Last name Green. First name Frank. Middle name is Hall. Just sounds more exciting than Frank Green.
It's great. No, in the tradition of all those three-part names in the John Hughes films, and, you know, you probably came up in those, right? And
I did. I grew up with those films. I love those movies. Yeah, John Hughes, R.I.P.
We're still mourning him. I just, as a matter of fact, and then we'll move into Wildlike. I was at a Q&A for Foxcatcher.
Yeah. Oh, great.
Did you see it?
I've seen it, and my producing partner, Tom, is a producer on that movie.
Is that right?
Yes.
Glad
Tom
there's
Heller.
The connection, then.
Yeah, so I went to Telluride as a part of the extended Foxcatcher mm-hmm. family. Never even met Bennett Miller, but it's a great movie. And, mm-hmm. you know, Tom Heller actually was the one who found the story in yes. a newspaper article and took it up to Bennett at
right?
a signing of his documentary, what was it, The Cruise, right?
The Cruise,
right?
About the eccentric...
Which I haven't seen, but I really want to
so
see.
Good.
I heard it's fabulous.
I have a copy of it.
Great.
That's how much I liked it.
So he brought it up to Bennett Miller, and he said, look, I think you should take a look at this. Yeah. I'd love to, you know, talk to you about doing this movie. And Bennett was like, whatever. And then, like, 6 weeks later, he's going through stuff on his desk. He opens it up, and he's like, this is my next movie. And got back in touch with Tom, and a 10-year journey began.
Wow. It's a remarkable film. One of the highlights of the New York Film Festival, which is where I did not go to Telluride, I was at the New York Film Festival, and Michael Anthony Hall, who you may recall plays
mm-hmm.
a
mm-hmm.
sort of the buffer guy, you know,
yeah.
the guy who the secretary, the this
yeah.
to DuPont, John DuPont, in the film. And so he was on the panel. It was pretty. I guess I've seen him in New York in the streets before, but it's always nice to see somebody like that because you know you kind of have a nostalgic connection to the roles that in those movies. Specifically, you know, in those 80s movies that we were just mentioning. I mentioned, too, also, speaking of nostalgically, when I was talking to Bruce Greenwood, who's the leading actor in your first feature, Wildlike, which is having its, I guess, East Coast premiere?
We
How
premiered
we
at the Hamptons
it?
Film Festival
oh, so it's not
this
your
past
East Coast
week.
Premiere. It's your it's, Hudson Valley premiere.
It's our Hudson Valley premiere. Woodstock was really gracious and obviously very enthusiastic about the film to say,
yes.
we're going to let it go to Hamptons and then come
very
to
much
us.
So
that was
project.
A big sign of yeah. how much they liked the movie.
It is. And I think they made a very good choice. I'm glad because I got to see it here and my first film here. This season and really, really
sorry the rest are going to be a letdown for you Paul.
The rest of the
that.
Yes yeah well you'll have to deal a lot with that I think because I was saying to Bruce as a that it just has such a strong center this film it's you really managed to make a film which knows what it's saying knows who it is which is I would imagine kind of a big feat for a first time feature filmmaker. I'm assuming you've made other films, whether or other shorts or commercials or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to the graduate film program at NYU from 2003. I technically graduated in 2008, I suppose. And I did, as an undergraduate in college, which I also went to NYU, to the Gallatin School, mm-hmm. I did take a little film production and a lot of film theory, and I was a photography major. Mm-hmm. So I started making little short films at that time, and, you know, I've probably made a dozen short films. Mm-hmm. And, you know, probably the one leading up to Before Wildlife was the most mature of those. And I think finding out what your movie's really about is a tough thing to do, because I really do feel like I rediscovered what Wildlife was about in the editing process and in the finishing process. And even now, you know, when talking with reviewers and audience members and people, I sort of rethink things. And, you know, the Kinsey and Bart relationship and the healing power of nature and their proximity and acceptance between each other is so central in the film. And that wasn't always completely evident to me, certainly in the writing of it. Mm-hmm. You know, in the writing of it, it was more about get this down on paper in the style that I want it and make it a story that people can believe and try to work these moments in a way that are interesting to the audience and where they don't maybe see what's coming.
Right. No, and I appreciated that also. I do. I like my favorite films are those that allow the audience to arrive at, that allow the audience to arrive at things on their own, that believe, you know, in the audience enough, in their intelligence, to allow them to figure it out, and that don't have to be so expository and so direct in that way, you know? Because it's so much more rewarding not to do that for the film, for audience members.
Especially today.
Yeah, right. We know. We've been watching movies for about 100 years.
Right.
Maybe a little bit more than that.
Yeah, and where are we going from here? At some point, there won't be any dialogue at all. It'll just be people walking around, looking at each other.
Right. At least we, you know, hey, listen, there's a lot of noise. So
yeah.
It's a good, I don't think that's always bad, silence. And
well,
there's a lot of open space and silence in Wildlife.
Yeah.
In other words, it's just about, I would say it's more than, but it's just about the same in terms of what's not said than what is said in this movie, what's going on there. In terms of, like, what these characters are about and how they relate to one another, there's a lot of stuff going on in the silences.
Yes, and in regards to the social issue aspect, it is directly about what is not said and what's kept inside and what,
what's,
you know,
silent,
doesn't want to be talked about by any parties involved.
Yeah. And in this case, sometimes that's about shame, and this is not about so much about shame, although I'm sure there is some of that, but it's also more just about protecting your butt and not getting caught and, you know, and thrown back into the wolf's den, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's great. So you went to NYU. Did you ever study under Todd Solondz? Or
I did a little bit. Todd's very generous guy.
Yeah.
He took the time. I was making a documentary at the time, and Todd took the time to review material with me and look at the rough cuts of the documentary. And he's a very open guy. And, you know, when I've run into him before or since then, he's always very friendly and remembers who I am. He's a great, great person and great to have at NYU.
He was on a show. I had him on.
What's here. That? Oh, great.
Had him on the
That's
podcast.
Great. And Spike Lee also is very generous with the students of the program.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you also had some encounters with Spike Lee?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Spike would give office hours. You'd go in, talk to him. He would take the time to read your projects and give you feedback and stay in touch.
It's nice to hear that.
Yeah.
Because as a public persona-wise, comes off kind of, you know, at, like confrontational and not easy. Like he's going to push back a bit. And when sometimes there's no need to. Very defensive.
Yeah.
You know, but it's nice to know that that there's this other.
The private persona is very strong, and I wouldn't say it's aggressive. It's very assertive, and it's direct, and it's not. It's unabashed in what he has to say, but it's not. I wouldn't say it's defensive, or it, you know, it's not what you see in the public.
Right, and also his feedback is about helping you, not trying to discourage. Yeah, which is important as a professor or teacher, instructor, mentor, whatever that role that you rely on like that as a young student. And so you made a documentary, or is this a school project?
It was technically a school project. It was my thesis project at school.
You use school equipment, so.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. Some of both. Yeah, and it was actually a feature documentary, and I used it to graduate from graduate film.
What was it about? You're smiling a little subconsciously.
I hesitate to bring it up because it's a long story. The movie is about my personal experience of being shot in the stomach by a gun on the streets of New York in, I guess, what maybe was a mugging. I don't really know what they wanted.
It was more just the intention wasn't so much getting something from you as just fucking you up.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The quick story is that I was walking down the street on St. Luke's Place, Leroy
West
Street,
Village.
In the West Village, between 7th Avenue and Hudson Street. And I lived right on Hudson Street between Leroy and whatever the next block up is. And it was 9 o'clock in September in 2007, and I was coming back from NYU. I was a camera assistant at the in the camera class. I was a teaching assistant, and saw these two guys standing on the sidewalk. And when I approached them or started to get close to them, I noticed that they just gave me a very eerie feeling. And they were positioned in the sidewalk in such a way that I had to walk between them. And so I just held my backpack, had headphones on, pulled them out, put them into my pocket, and just kind of forged ahead, kind of with my head down. And when I got up to them, they go, "Hold up, nigger." And then I heard a loud bang, and they ran off. And that's really all I knew at that time. I didn't even feel anything. I just heard this bang and ran.
Went into shock. Your buddy went into shock, obviously.
Yeah, and then after they were halfway down the block, I started burning. Actually felt like a burning on the outside, like as if you took a match and held it to your skin.
Yeah.
And then shortly later, I looked down. I didn't see anything. I could have started to walk on, and the pain increased. I looked down again.
St. Vincent would have been there, so go ahead. Continue.
Right, and then a couple of steps later, I finally looked down, and there was blood gathering around my belt line.
Oh, my God.
And they had basically shot me. It had gone in the front left lower abdomen and gone across my stomach and come out on the right.
Wow.
So, I mean, they had put it up to my stomach, and I guess because of my trajectory of moving and the angle of the gun, they hadn't quite gotten it, you know, straight into my stomach and spine and so forth. I got very lucky in that regard.
Very lucky.
Yeah.
Because as far as I can tell, you're doing all right.
Yeah, I mean, it was like in the movies, you know, I stumbled into this restaurant and I said, "I think I've been shot." It's all very surreal.
Right, of course.
And I immediately sat, which turned into lying on the ground. And in the ambulance, you know, cops came, ambulance came, they rushed me to the hospital. And there was a moment there in the ambulance where it was clear from what they were saying over the wire that it was very serious, you know, or if you get shot in the stomach,
right,
it's very, very serious.
Yeah.
But I fortunately,
they call it gut shot.
Yeah.
In the old days.
Yeah. So, but I was fine. They sent me home the next day with two Band-Aids.
What?
Yeah. It didn't hit any organs or anything.
What?
It literally just crossed through this little
flesh
pocket of fat here on my stomach.
Thank God for that. That protective layer over your rock hard solid abs.
Right. But the interesting twist to the story is that my wife now, who was my girlfriend then, we were broken up at the time, just recently. I think maybe 2 weeks before that. And it was traumatizing for me. And that was everything that was going on in my life. Was sort of getting her back, suffering from the breakup. She had taken a trip that weekend that we were supposed to do together down to Atlanta, our hometown, and so she was gone. And I literally called her from the floor of the restaurant and was like, "My Molly, it's Frank. I've been shot. And, you know, I'm inside the restaurant, and I'm okay. But call me, please." And she didn't end up even getting, you know, what, you know, 19 messages plus messages from the hospital and neighbors and so forth until like 2 o'clock in the morning. So wrapped inside this really intense experience, where it's, I guess, technically somewhat of a near-death sort of thing, was this layer of, you know, emotion and importance to me of what I really wanted to be happening in my life, which sort of just overshadowed the whole event in this odd way and brought her back to me. Also, and now we're married. And so that's if you're broken up and you need to get your girlfriend back and you're really, really desperate, you can't arrange to have this done, but they have to shoot very carefully.
Yeah.
It's going to go across the front
of the
stomach.
You may want to try to find those original two guys. Speaking of which, did they?
I didn't even get a look at them. Even if they had caught guys and put them up to me, I wouldn't have been able to identify them positively.
Right, because you're trying to get through that as quickly as you can
I think
and
they
not
have,
get shot, and that didn't happen.
I mean, I think they have coming to them whatever they have coming to them.
Well, it already came to them if they're at that point, too, where they would be as...
So
cowardly to do something like that to another person. It's sort of like they're already kind of in a hell. I mean, who does that?
Right.
That isn't in some sort of hell already.
Right.
That, you know, is obviously.
So the documentary was a sort of personal, private thing. I didn't ever, you know, put it out or send it out to film festivals
or
anything.
Help you in any way?
If someone wants to see it, they can contact me and I see it. But other than that, it's not for public consumption.
Understood. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it got you. You graduated?
I graduated, yeah.
Okay, well, that's all that. Wow, that's quite a story. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
It's not necessary.
It's called Shooting Script. It's the name of the documentary.
Okay. which ultimately is odd because the postscript to it is that it is a romantic story because, you know, you got the girl.
Yeah, it is romantic. It's true.
It's amazing. It's an amazing, I don't know, it's like that became that, you know, like being shot became finding your love, you know, maybe of your life or, you know, the one who didn't get away.
Yeah.
So that's got to change things. So not only that, but you say you're from Atlanta and you, which is not, it's, there's, Atlanta is a city with edge and with grit and it has an urban center. So it's not like you're naive coming to New York City.
Maybe no.
New York City, statistically, the crime might be about the same per capita.
I think Atlanta's more dangerous than New York now.
Okay,
yeah,
right,
for sure.
New York is, there's nowhere to get mugged except on that little stretch of West Village that you described 8 years ago. I guess what I'm going to ask is, it was in 2007, you had another, you were in undergraduate or
graduate?
You were in graduate. You had two more years left? Is that what you said?
One more year.
One more year? So yeah, obviously you weren't going to leave and throw it all away. Had that happened earlier on, you might have said, oh, fuck it, I'm going to go. I'm leaving New York City.
Yeah, no, definitely not my type of thing. I mean, I'm a very adventuresome, sort of overreaching, ambitious character. As you can see from
the film,
shooting a first feature in Alaska, I go for it.
But that actually makes a lot of practical sense to those filmmakers listening to shoot in Alaska. They may take a lesson from you because not only are there tax incentives for shooting there, but it's easier to shoot on a very small crew, right? And there aren't tons of people who are going to be trying to, you know, get in the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's about it. But you shot in the summer.
Yes.
So it wasn't like the Alaska, like buried in snow.
No, it's, you know it's kind of like the Northwest in the summer if you go to some place like, you know, Jackson Hole or Glacier National Park in Montana or one of those.
Sure.
It's very mild. It's very dry.
But you're warm and like this in the day.
It's not this warm, but it can get into the mid-70s during the day. And it typically, you know, is around mid-60s to 70. It's quite nice. Yeah, yeah.
We're outside of Woodstock, and it's...
Yeah, I mean, there were some days we were all in T-shirts. Right. Absolutely. It's a great place in the summer.
Yeah, imagine. I've never been to Alaska, and if you shoot another film up there, I would love to do, like, we could do some podcasting from the set. I did that on a recent film, and we're following the trajectory of the film. So it was in Connecticut, not quite Alaska. Lovely town, New London, Connecticut, we shot.
Mm-hmm.
They were shooting a production. I interviewed a lot of the key people from the film.
That's great.
And then I haven't aired any of it yet. My idea is to, I think this particular project, given who's involved, will get to a major film festival. So then it would pick up the interviews from there, and then through distribution choices and all that, and then kind of the lifespan of a film, indie film anyway. That was the idea for that. And so
that's great.
I'm willing to do that if you go to Alaska.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll go somewhere very exciting for our next feature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, kind of starting off the conversation, this particular film really does have a strong center to it. And I'm just wondering how you did manage to figure that out. Like, in other words, I know that you said in response to that you learn a lot after the fact and about what you were saying, like you might thinking about a dream you had. In other words, you're learning, oh, I didn't intend to do this and that, but clearly this is going on and maybe I was doing this unconsciously or what have you. But there had to be a level of conscious, deliberate ideas that you were fleshing out going into the film, because your character is just really, there's a well-constructed film, what I'm trying to say.
I think the way that I construct stories is I've got probably 5 features that I've written now, and I have a very strong pattern, and the way that things happen is that first they start with imagery and ideas of people in circumstances, whether it's someone in nature or a person undergoing a certain, you know, event, generally tied around anxiety or intensity or angst or a breaking point. And I start from that moment, and then I build the story out. And so I think because I have an attraction to having people under intense circumstances, that it ends up being a wealth of themes that just sort of emanate from that.
Okay.
And so the themes sort of come out after I pin the story together. I say, well, it would be exciting if this happens, and then it would be, you know, really fabulous if this happens. And I try to bring something to the screen that maybe people haven't seen before or maybe haven't seen in that way. I had a great, fabulous instructor at NYU named Boris Fruman, who's still there, a Russian film director, and he always said, you know, we would watch The movies that we would bring in, he's like, eh, I've seen this before. I've seen it before. And that goes through my mind when I'm writing a script. Have we seen this before?
Interesting.
You know, yeah. And if there if we have seen it before, even if it's an important scene of, you know, I'm working on a script right now and a woman has a conversation with her father, it's like, I don't want the conversation to take place in his office at work. I don't want the conversation to take place in the study. I don't want the conversation to take place in the bedroom. Where has this conversation never taken place on the screen before?
But shouldn't it also be, where do actual conversations happen? Where do conversations do occur?
Right.
Maybe they, you know, the side of the road or something. I don't know. Right. Like,
right.
But it seems like even that you have a series of themes and then you whittle it down over time. And it, and this movie seems to be also, you did a lot of whittling and right. And carving out to have almost like the most, it's a minimalist film on a certain level.
Yeah. And it was a movie. It's a movie about a journey.
Right.
You know, at the origin, it was a movie about a journey. And this is a journey.
Right.
That this person's taking a journey through pain, a journey through recovery, but then an actual adventure journey that she's taking. And I really wanted the audience to go on that journey, but I didn't want them to go on that journey empty handed or without loaded emotions and anxiety. You know, I wanted to take with it a message, both in terms of what happens to her and where she goes to. And to me, you know, life is about experiencing pain to whatever degree it is, maybe very, very mild or very, very intense, and then experiencing the recovery and healing from that, whether very, very mild. And I really think life fluctuates through those on a minute-by-minute daily basis all the way along. And, you know, you're never actually even and balanced. You know, maybe you are if you are very, very practiced
right.
in a spiritual way, and that's a great thing to shoot for. But I think the interest in characters and what people relate to is, you know, those ups and downs.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. The film is called Wild Like. Obviously, you're just at the early stages of the festival run. And a film like this, I think it really deserves a festival run, because it's the kind of film where you really will get to build a community around the film and meet people that are going to, you know, support it. And, you know, I think it's certain films just benefit from doing festivals, you know, and you can gauge how to market the film too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can help. It can be very instructive, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, we're definitely experiencing that. And
because you don't have a huge marketing budget, I'm guessing.
No, we don't. I mean, we have a sales agent, Kevin Iwashima, and Preferred Content, and they're terrific. And we've been working with some PR people. But a lot of the work has been, okay, you know, what is the festival life going to be? And once we established that Hamptons was going to take the world premiere, then we immediately started talking to a lot of other festivals. And now we have 20 festivals lined up just in the next 2 months.
Oh, lovely.
And, you know, in some of the best festivals, Napa Valley, St. Louis, Stars Denver is doing a special spotlight with honoring Bruce Greenwood.
Who is?
Stars Denver.
Stars, yeah.
Kookaloras is coming up. Savannah, Indy Memphis right after this. Austin right after this is really excited about the movie. So, I mean, I really think that we, you know, most of the best festivals through the fall we're going to. And then in the spring, you know, we're talking to a lot of the top festivals too. So I think the fact that our acceptance rate has been so high is a reflection on the film. And like you said, I do think that when we get to those festivals, the audiences will enjoy the film. And some people respond very, very passionately. And, you know, and the more people that, like yourself, who come and take the time to watch the movie and talk about us, that's what we'll use to prove, you know, to the world that it's worth putting out there. And the more we will believe then in investing in the distribution and the marketing ourselves.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Of course, because you get the benefits of that.
Right.
I wish you all the luck with that.
Thank you very much.
And we'll look out for that. And around that, maybe I have no doubt that we'll have the opportunity to sit together again come the theatrical of the film.
Anytime. Sure. Yeah. Reach out to me.
I'm sure you'll be in my neck of the woods around that time.
And, yes.
I'm sure.
I live in New York. I'm there all the time.
You are. You're based in New York?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you live?
I'm up on the Upper East Side, 97th.
Right
off of Madison.
Okay, nobody needs to go there and wait on the corner. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's
there's at the Bodego on the... Anyway, lovely meeting you, by the way, Frank.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for talking with Bruce. I know he really enjoyed it.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Adam.
Stick to the road.
I'm not going back on the road. I'm hiking, too.
We get 100 yards from the tent. We don't make fires.
I know what I'm doing.
You have no idea.
Hey,
how far can these things fly? Could this go, like, all the way to Seattle?
Well, are you ready to go home?
Whatever you do, don't run. Do not run.
Check, 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 check. Yeah, I can see it. Looks good.
This is a great device. It's very reliable.
I remember when these things came out. And this got this the perfect, the, what do they call it, coincidental opposition of these two mics.
Yeah, it's a very unusual.
Coincident stereo.
It's going to taser them with this.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't it look like that?
It's a combination recorder slash taser.
It's a 4-track too, right? Is it not? Or is it just a stereo thing? Track.
Well,
Don't tell me you don't know, Adam.
I do. It is just stereo.
Just stereo?
Well,
okay.
You can use it, and you can use the internal mics or
These, it looks like they've seen some action.
Yeah, this was a filmmaker friend of mine lent this to me, and I've never returned it. So I gotta have to get okay. one. Parts. We're in Canada.
It's not vampire heavy here at Woodstock anyway. First, it's a way more laid back. Than,
it is.
You know.
Yeah, the vampires here would be like
Rip Van Vampire kind of. It's very very
peace,
mellow.
Peace loving vampires. It's a contradiction.
Yeah, they just kind of peace you to death.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Talking with
they
Bruce
hang up
Green.
Garlic just to make the food look good and stuff like that. You know, rather than to ward off.
Right. Garlic. Garlic and these vampires are attracted to patchouli. I don't know how to. I don't know. I'm front out of jokes.
No, it's okay. There's a lot of patchouli here. There's a serious incense thing going on in virtually half the stores.
I'm kind of actually impressed while we're on the subject of. I haven't been here in a few number of years, but they kind of do keep up this. You know, what would you call it? Not the Woodstock. Not, I hate the term brand, so I'm going to try to think of something else. But the Woodstock lore, the Woodstock character, which is like the hippie peace. They keep it's everywhere still, and it like you will see tie dye people like with that look like they still just stepped out of a three day concert of music and crafts.
I'm kind of surprised at the percentage of people that have Rip Van beards and you know the tie dyed and the dreads and everything. But it's kind of cool. It actually makes it feel as though it's not as much of an affectation, like the fact that every store has a picture of Jimmy or, you know, the band or whomever, you know, you kind of think, well, there's a bunch of people who were there who were still here.
Yeah. And but, you know, they did use I guess from coming out of the festival was such an enormous cultural moment in time that it did become a commercialized thing for so many years that when you come here, it's like, oh, wait a minute, this isn't exactly that. But it's also not, you know, people like living in tents or protesting something.
There goes Dennis Hopper now.
Exactly. God bless him, too. Well, we're talking with Bruce Greenberg.
I've heard that before, Adam.
Actor Bruce Greenwood. Yeah, open up your water.
Never mind. Ness.
All right. I've been following your career for quite a while, actually, so it's really nice that this whole converged to...
Yeah, I've been around as long as some of these bearded, tie-dyed cats that are walking around Woodstock.
Well, I don't know about that.
Finally, you know, I have been.
Yeah, but you've been acting in films at least for going. Well, it must be around 3 decades now. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that
not to
like
put
that?
Too fine a point on it. Three decades easy.
I don't. Okay.
Yeah.
You're from Canada, right? Which?
Well, yeah, I was born in Quebec, but I grew up in. Actually, I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey.
Did you?
Until sixth grade, and then we moved to Canada.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then lived in Canada until grade 12. Year moved to Switzerland, then moved back to Vancouver.
Oh, you lived in Switzerland for a while?
Yeah, for a year. My dad was doing some research there.
Oh, okay. And then back to Canada again?
Yep, and back to Vancouver. And then eventually, you know, packed all our stuff in a little rabbit and drove to L.A.
Okay. Which was at least on that right side of the coast or the right side of the country.
Yeah, I went to school in New York, I only lived there while I was going to school.
Where'd you go?
I went to the American Academy.
Okay. And you studied theater or acting anyway?
Yeah.
Well, it paid off.
Yeah, it's all I can do.
No, I mean...
Oh, is this one of your guys?
This is the founder of the Woodstock Film Festival.
Ah, greetings.
How are you?
How are you doing?
Good to see you, Laurent. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. He's a co-founder of the festival with Mayura. This is kind of
I have a sneaking suspicion he was at the original event. hair down in the middle of his back.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. His name is Laurent, so he could be
Laurent.
Canadian too.
Ah ouais.
Quoi?
Ah oui.
Quoi? Ah oui, parfait.
Tu parles français?
Je sais.
Well, that means I know.
Right. Oh,
do you speak French? You go, yeah, I know.
I thought it was je serai. I will try.
I will, yes.
Okay.
I thought you said je sais, but I don't speak, so I shouldn't be correcting you.
You don't?
No.
Okay.
I lived there for 6 months.
Okay. Man, I'm getting all over the place here, but that's fine, too. So because you were in L.A., I guess I'm thinking you didn't do a lot of theater there, but although there is a theater world.
Very little. I started doing television sort of right away and then sort of bounced between television and movies and whatever was available for the longest time, and I still do.
Uh-huh. What were some of the early films that you...
Well, the earliest film with which I padded my resume shamelessly was First Blood.
Uh-huh. Is that right?
Rambo.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Man. What was that experience like?
Well, from an extras perspective, it was astonishing. You know, got to see Sly walking back and forth at a distance.
At the height of his...
At the
apex of his career.
Yeah, sort of mid-ascendancy, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So that that was exciting and instructive and everything, and in spite of how arduous it is being an extra, you know.
Were you allowed to talk to him? I mean, you know, some people
are
told.
Are you joking? No.
No?
No.
Really?
Encouraged not to look in that direction, in fact.
I don't know if you're exaggerating.
Not really.
Yeah. Because I would imagine I'm not to get too carried away on Sylvester Stallone, but that, you know, this is a guy who put together, I mean, this is against all odds. He kind of came from nothing in a way, and then he created one of the most famous films in all the world. So
he carved out a big piece of Hollywood real estate for himself out of, you know, just purely on his own. I mean, it's impressive, no matter how you look at it.
Yeah. Did you have at that time coming up, just starting off, did you have in mind the type of roles that you wanted to do? Clearly, that guy had sort of figured out his way.
No, I never had that kind of. I never had that kind of vision. I never had that kind of foresight. I just wanted. I really wanted to be, you know, as much of a changeling as I could.
Did you?
Yeah,
did
I did.
Did you see yourself more than a character actor, even though you could be cast as the leading man because you had?
I think most actors do.
Right.
If they're thinking about
longevity.
If they're thinking about the person they're playing, the quote unquote character they're playing. You don't think in terms of, I mean, I never did. I never sort of wasn't smart enough to think in terms of trying to use the way I appeared to other people. You know, I always saw myself as, you know, I think we all see ourselves as pretty just kind of normal looking, you know, nothing special. So you don't try and mine that claim even if there is territory there, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't quite so, what's the term?
I was completely unself-aware.
Okay.
That's not to say it wasn't self-conscious.
Were there, and again, going back into the first, let's say, period of time when you were starting to get roles, were there any actors that were inspirations, I guess?
Yeah, there's a guy, and he's still around, a guy named Brad Dourif, if you're familiar with Brad. Yeah. I mean, he's one of my favorite actors ever, and he's the reason I wanted to become an actor.
Really?
Yeah.
Once, I would say, like almost in a very obscure choice, and yet on the other hand, an actor's actor, just like one of those faces that you see pop up.
Yeah,
in
no matter
so
what he
many
does,
films.
It's riveting. And when,
he's worked for everybody
when I was a kid,
too.
I was watching Cuckoo's Nest, and I saw him do that, and I went, "Wow, that's where I want to be."
He was for people who maybe he kind of like a bug-eyed a little bit, right? Wasn't he kind of a little bug-eyed a little bit, like? I don't know how to explain.
No, he had and still has a sort of very chiseled face, but he's a very intense guy with he radiates intensity, I guess, for lack of a better
word. That's a good word. No, it's a good way to put it. And then, you know, worked for everybody. Like, I remember Herzog. You did a film with Herzog, I think.
Oh, yeah. He's a great catch forever is working with him.
Yeah. And not also a leading man type either, so it's kind of, it is... I could see that you were interested in other things. Now, what was the... here's where I was trying to remember before I sat down with you. The Hereafter?
The Sweet Hereafter.
Sweet Hereafter,
yeah.
Thank you. I think, you know, quite honestly, although somehow or other I miss your role in Rambo, but...
Guardsman number four, if
listen,
you're looking for it.
I'm going to go back. Trust me. Yeah. But, and we're going to, by the way, if we will get to Wildlife, good, because it's really an exceptionally great film. But now that I have you, talk about a couple of things like The Sweet Hereafter, which, you know, put you on my radar.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was so terribly moved by that film. And your performance in it, I think it's one of the great films to come out of that period of time, actually. I think it was a really remarkable.
Well, it's from a book that still resonates today by Russell Banks and Adam McGoyan, who wrote the screenplay, just found a way into telling that story in a really complete way that also played with time in a way that the novel didn't. And that's one of the things that Adam is, you know, I suppose you could say famous for. So he found a way to unpack the story in this elliptical, almost backward way. And that made it, you know, in a sense, it was one of those things where all you have to do is just do do your tiny part, and it becomes part of this whole that's more than the sum, you know?
Yeah. And as a director, that experience, he was a...
We first met when we did Exotica, so we'd already become friends by then.
Okay, yes. And maybe I did... I obviously saw you in that, too, because that was maybe my first Adam O'Goyan film.
And, you know, I was hidden behind a big beard in that movie.
Okay,
And then in The Sweet Hereafter, I was sort of playing with big tufts of facial hair, and I thought, well, I'll show up for work with a beard, and we'll just... I talked to Adam on the phone. He said, yeah, we'll just chop off bits of it till we're happy with what you feel Billy should look like. So we did that, and, you know, big mutton chops, lose them, lose the goatee, you know, but then we ended up with a big kind of sweeper mustache. Went,
yes.
Oh, that's good. And I said to him, I suddenly had this thought, should I take out my front tooth? And he goes, what? I said, I can take out my front tooth, because at the time I had one of those flippers because I had my tooth knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I popped it out and smiled, and he went, oh, man, oh, I don't know. Okay.
A little tense, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
He butt in.
You know, and then we realized, okay, we've got to find a place early in the movie for me really to grin widely so it's clear that he's missing a tooth, so you're not going, what the hell, what did I just see? Has he got a raisin stuck
in
his mouth?
This is intentional, right.
Yeah.
And this is an intentional character choice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so we did that, but he's just such a great guy to work for. He's just one of those guys who lets you come in swinging hard, you know?
I would love to talk to him someday, too. You know, definitely when I was starting to really think about independent film and that type of filmmaking in a more broader way in terms of, film, there are these kinds of filmmakers that are doing this type of thing. He was an early filmmaker that I really admired and always looked forward to. It's during that period from Exotica through Sweet Hereafter and a couple of more films, getting more and more intense. And he was made some amazing films during that period of time. You know, and now as he's entering his autumn part of his career, you know, his, like, now he's kind of more mature.
Early for them.
Well, I don't mean his winter.
Autumn
no,
part
no.
Of his
but you know
career.
What I'm saying. Well, I know it's true.
We're very,
it's
not a, lot, a, good of, way not to a get. Lot of people know that we're very, we're young men.
We are very young.
I mean, just and a little silver in the beard, as you well know, doesn't indicate
no
age of any kind.
I do want to distinguish between autumn and winter. Nowhere near winter yet, so we're just entering sort of our, you know, it's a good thing. This is a good period. You're getting probably the best roles of your career now, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think I probably am. Yeah, I'm tremendously fortunate. Anyway, you know, I'm just very, I feel fortunate to still, honestly, to still be doing it, even though I feel like I get a little better as the years go by. You know, it's still. Mm-hmm. It's really competitive, and it's not an easy industry to be in, you know?
Yeah. And you sort of have learned how to navigate between studio films and these indie films. What's that process like? Where did the scripts come from, I guess, is the
question.
It
used to be, you know, up until about 3 or 4 years ago, it used to be, well, look, I'll do whatever I can get. You know, I'll do virtually anything. I mean, I say no to things I think are terrible, but whether it's television or whether it's independent or whether it's sort of studio-based, it wasn't as though I was really trying to balance those elements, and now I am trying to balance them a little bit.
I'm being
a little more judicious in what I choose to do, right? Like choosing to do Wildlife was one of those things where I really liked the script, and the environment really, really appealed to me. And, you know, we made it on a shoestring, and it doesn't really matter, you know. If you can get up there with 15 guys and a camera and a couple of actors and do what you intended to do, then that's kind of what I'm sort of finally coming to. Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Well, the scary thing is, even if you are judicious in terms of what you choose, the center may not always hold in terms of what ends up happening with the film, not only from a post-production standpoint, but from also a marketing and, you
that's
know,
true
it's,
in any film,
distribution. Of
that's
course,
true
yes.
In, from right. the biggest tent pole to right. the tiniest indie,
true.
You can.
So there's always that risk factor, right?
Yeah, all the ingredients are laid out there, and you go, I understand how I would put these ingredients together, and I think they're going to taste great, and either you were wrong about how those elements should come together, or somebody else thinks something differently and puts it together, and it does nothing like what you imagined.
Peter, what's the director? I'm sorry,
Frank Hall Green.
Frank, I beg your pardon. Frank Hall Green, who is the director? See, I can edit that. I make no mistakes on my show. Crazy coincidence.
Oh, good. I'll relax.
Yeah. Yes. You won't either. I try to make my guests.
Yes, you can cut me to ribbons very easily.
No. Yeah. That's a good way to gauge my audience. Is to you're I think a very beloved actor. Actually, I think people like you. You have a and you haven't had any YouTube moments that I'm familiar with.
But that's a funny thing. You know, they asked me last night, hey, we're doing a bunch of karaoke, right? And
yeah.
I went, you know, I'd love to, but
right.
back in the day, yeah, jump up and, you know, have a couple before. Drinks and have fun and suck, you
yeah,
know?
Sure.
But
misbehave.
Not so much now.
No.
You know?
Yeah, there's no more misbehaving. It's a double-edged sword.
But you're going to ask me something about Frank Hall Green.
Yeah, what he executed with Wildlike is a really... just a solid piece of filmmaking, which for me is the big takeaway. You know, like if I go in and I just feel like I have seen something that's strongly directed that really says something, that knows what it's saying, I guess that's really key. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who knows what he's trying to do, and it's his first feature. I'm always so impressed with that, you know.
Well, the script was...
He's brought, by the way... Hopper's back with Fonda.
He's circling
and
us now. He's yeah, circling us now. And he's got a weird look in his eye.
Right back the rig.
He's got the skull cap going, and
yeah. he's back.
Wow, that was very effective, Adam, giving him the evil eye like that. You know, coming from for a journalist to have that kind of power to
Thank
will
you.
That guy away, that was pretty amazing.
I like to think it was me.
I have a sneaking suspicion he's a lawyer midweek. It was just the
yes,
bike was just
honestly,
a little too shiny.
I know what you mean.
No, I was going to say the script itself was strong. Going in, and its basic elements were pretty compelling. Oh, thanks. And then Frank and I had some long discussions about how to make those moves in the script more effective. And some of our choices were really clear, and other choices were more elusive. But ultimately, I think we made something that has a real heart and also has something to say and asks the audience at the end of the day to consider what they've seen and to contextualize that within their own experience of the things that these characters went through and ask the questions of themselves that the characters are forced to ask at the end of the movie.
Yes, but I would also say that it's not an issue film. It doesn't come across as an issue film, like as a Lifetime
no.
or anywhere near that. This is a dramatic film about characters, about it's a story-driven, character-driven film, and it, you know, in the greatest sense of the terms. And let's just say 14-year-old Mackenzie runs away from her circumstances where she's staying with her uncle in order... that's okay. We were hearing the producer and director. It's okay. That's not...
Unbelievable.
Unless they're...
Well, when you say first-time director, often...
Oh, I see.
They won't stop talking.
I don't know if he's a first-time director, but I know it's his first feature. I assume he made something in the past. I assume he's made a few things. But she runs away. They're in Alaska, and she runs away, and she runs into your character, Renee Bartlett, or
an
Bart,
event.
As we, you're
she's this 14-year-old girl. An event happens in her life with a member of her family that drives her away, of which she's terrified. She doesn't know where to run, and she finds herself, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Alaska with no one to turn to, and she tries to attach herself to a couple of people, and it doesn't quite work out, and then she sees this guy that I play, Renee Bartlett, and maybe has a sense that there's safety there, and maybe at this point it doesn't really matter. She just need somebody to
yeah.
to sort of stand under the umbrella with. And she attaches herself to him in the middle of nowhere. And he's trying to pull himself out of an event in his own life that's closed him off. So between the two of them, they draw one another out very slowly.
Yes, and you both need some level of healing, which, if it's not in an active way, it's sort of in a more passive way. You're able to sort of lean on each other on some level. That's going on there, too.
Just by virtue of the interaction, they're both very closed.
Yeah.
And quiet people, and it takes, and that's one of the one of the beautiful things about the film is that the silences between them are sort of echo pretty loudly, especially given the physical environment of the movie, right?
Yeah,
which is this huge, grand vista that we shot in Denali National Park, where I'd never been before, and was one of the things that attracted me in the first place, right?
No doubt.
You get up there, and in fact, the whole crew, we only had 30 people. And, you know, lots of times we'd have to hike a quarter of a mile to get to the location. And we were all just sort of astounded at the vistas and the environment.
I can't imagine.
It was a great 6 weeks. It was really fun.
Yeah, I was thinking about what you were saying before, though, about the quiet. There's a lot of silence in the film, too. Some of that silence, there's tension. And I just can appreciate when I was at the Q&A
last night
uh-huh. That's where I saw it, and I was that you intentionally kept taking out too much.
As
a team, creative team, it was stuff that was telling people things or too obvious. It's like, let the audience keep arriving at things on their own. Every time you have something that is kind of like telling you something in a very maybe in an expository way, it would come out, you take it out. That's really, I think, great. You know,
we really tried to winnow out the exposition.
Yeah,
and that was kind of after the fact when we were shooting it. We thought, well, we need to explain this and we need to explain that. And
no, you don't, right? Then you were like,
but the thing is, feel as though you have to have that just in case
the
audience is really scratching their head and going, I'm dissatisfied with how it's progressing, right?
Right.
So in the first couple of cuts, there was a lot of that exposition that was ultimately revealed to be unnecessary. Mm-hmm. So it makes it cleaner, and you can allow more silences to resonate, right? And the audience in those silences can make some assumptions of their own that deepen the film for them.
And the audience feels like they're being treated with like they're intelligent, too, and I don't know if it's an active thought, but you come out of there feeling not like you've been dumbed down on some level. Like, it's nice to be in a film where you can arrive at things like the filmmakers have enough trust in their audience that they can figure it out and they can arrive at things without being told, you know, so much.
Well, and
you can do that more in a film than you can in a book or in a written piece.
Oh, yeah, because you're taking a risk, right? You know, the big studio pictures, you want to make sure that everybody walks out basically feeling the same thing and feeling good about what they've seen, so they can say, you got to go see this.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of movie, you have the liberty to make it, to allow it to be more elliptical, you know, and allow it to be something that might mean one thing to somebody and another thing to someone else.
Being careful so I don't give away certain things, but there is a lot of tension, as I did refer to a few minutes ago, in the film too, in terms of her sense of what she's always dealing with, in terms of her being potentially caught, or I can take some of this away, I'm going to just speak freely, that she could, of course, be apprehended, or she can be, you know, she's on the go, so there's some tension there. There's tension with your character because you're putting yourself at risk as well by traveling alone with her, albeit there's a couple of things that happen where, you know, you're showing, obviously, that, you know, when you call the police, for instance, right when you came down from the mountain, things that you brought up last night. Again, I might
edit. You can, chop it until you make
Yeah, because I don't want to, well, I also don't want to, like, give away too much of the film's
bad. I don't know that it's a bad thing to use the word predator necessarily up front, and people will know what that's about.
Yeah. You're not a predator.
She has this event. if you say an event within her family, everybody knows what that is, right?
Kind of.
So,
yeah.
and it's not, although the film has, it has a point of view about that, it doesn't ask you, it doesn't demand of the viewer to share that point of view.
Right.
And the way it's open at the end in terms of the consequences,
right.
I think is one of the things that remind us what's the word, it's in terms of the consequences at the end of the film. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that it's not an easy thing to resolve, right?
Right.
It's not an.
You can put them in jail, but that doesn't also necessarily resolve the bigger issues, or the damage, or healing. And
it's not a morality play.
Yeah, right? There's no 1-800 number at the end of the film either. You know, this is not about that. This is about healing.
You know, it's somebody said last night that if there had been more stricter, heavier consequences for one of these characters, then it would have been more upbeat. The ending would have been more upbeat, quote unquote. But then Joe Steffens, our producer, said last night as we were driving home, he said, it's an upbeat in a life. So the way the movie ends, there's an upbeat in her life and an upbeat in his life. But it's not as though a solution has been created.
Right. Yeah.
It's a nice upbeat in somebody's life where there's the potential for healing, there's the potential for positive change and all that. It's no guarantee. And you know, a lot of times in the movies you want that neat ending. You want that guarantee of happiness. And here you get the suggestion that happiness is possible, and the rest is up to fate, circumstance, intention. And good fortune.
There's even like some tension though with this landscape, because I'm thinking as I'm watching the glaciers, man, these things are in danger. And, you know, it's like even that, or the bear. There's tension in nature as well, which is a component of the film, which is almost, you could say, a character in the film is Alaska, is the vista, as you described it.
Well, to some degree, if you go with the idea that these characters at the outset are closed, right, locked up or closed, then the grandness of this physical environment invites opening, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so, you know, I know this is maybe a terrible analogy, but if you think of a huge blossom with something with a pistol in the center of it, you know, and as the blossom opens, the pistol has room to express itself.
Yeah. So
that's a terrible analogy. I would not use that. It's, you know, because what does the pistol really do besides, you know, spew pollen? And it's not appropriate.
Well, we're going back into territory here that is dangerous.
Yeah.
No, but it is a really strong work, and it must be, I'm guessing, the kind of legacy you want to leave as an actor, films like this, it's a nice opportunity for you to, carry a film.
I've played so many guys with hidden agendas that, you know, who look like decent human beings, but ultimately are not entirely.
Right.
And this was an opportunity to play a guy, although he had troubles, was at bottom fundamentally a really decent man,
right?
And those are not actually that easy to come by, surprisingly, because drama often doesn't allow the protagonist to be a really truly decent guy.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
they always have to have these serious flaws in order to make them quote unquote interesting,
right?
And although this guy was closed, I think you understand pretty early on that he's a decent man.
Yeah, right. In fact, I remember a more recent performance in, let's say, Flight, right? Mm-hmm. Your character, much more complex there in some ways. Like, how do you, you know, play that character where here is a guy who is looking after who's at odds in a way with protecting someone who clearly made some corrupt choices. So ethically speaking, he's in very, very fuzzy terrain, isn't he? I don't remember
the
character's
name.
Yeah,
the internal conflict there is: do you protect a friend? Do you save a friend from himself, if you can?
Yeah.
At the expense of 5,000 other people with whom you're not as close but have a profound responsibility. So, and he makes the effort and makes the effort, and finally his, you know, Denzel's character won't allow himself to be saved because only he can do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just remember that I really enjoy. I watched it again actually not long ago. Flight. Anyway.
It's a good movie.
It really is good.
So good.
He is really good at the. Yeah. I have not seen.
I guess he does. A movie with James Batchdale, who was the guy Flight who played the cancer patient with the cigarette in the stairwell.
Oh, okay.
And he's starring in this big legendary movie.
That's the name of it.
It's called Spectral.
Spectral. Is it a science fiction film?
Yeah,
or it sounds
kinda,
a
sorta,
bit?
Yeah. Or it'll be out in 2016.
Oh, I see. So that's something that's coming up. Anything else? A couple other things.
One thing called Fathers and Daughters with Russell Crowe. Another thing called Good Kill with Ethan Hawke. And Wildlike.
When is that? What's the date on Wildlike? We could call.
Well, we haven't.
Frank,
it's
or,
not.
Okay, you're still in the.
It
you're just
release yet. So.
Right. This was. Where was it? Is this at Woodstock Film Festival? This is not the world premiere.
No, it premiered at Hamptons last week.
Oh, it did.
Yeah.
I was supposed to go.
Oh, really? It was fun, and then we're going.
But
to,
it is a good festival,
Austin,
right?
Next week.
Oh, you are for the Austin Film Festival, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think hopefully in that time we'll get you know enough people like you will have seen it to, and sort of weighed in on what they think its value is, and then you know that's kind of part of the deal with these small
this size
films.
Movie.
You try and get as many if you believe in it, you try and get as many people as you can to see it, and hopefully they'll feel the same way.
Right. Yeah. No, I think this we'll find an audience. They're pretty secure in that.
It was impossible to say watching it in the screening room when you're just there with the director who's going to respond to it, you know, but people have been responding really surprisingly. I mean, really like to a man, really. You know?
Yeah. Well, somebody brought up last night and it seemed to light a little bit of a spark in the audience when you guys talked about Team Wildlike because this idea now of which so many independent filmmakers are now aware of the importance, indeed the crucial neat nature of having to create a community around your film because those are the people that are going to spread the good word, you know, and that are going to be your ambassadors, you know, for your film. And it's so important because there's so many, the playing field is so broad and so wide and so deep that with films and how do you find your audience when there's so many films coming out, 20 films in a week sometimes or more.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really a crowded arena, and it's and you just have to hope that somehow there's enough magnetism in the thing that you've been part of creating that people get drawn to it and it develops a momentum of its own.
Well, the digital age has opened things up for almost anybody to make a movie and even to sort of distribute it in one way or another, right? Because there are new methods now.
Yeah.
So it's made it difficult for a lot of people, too, because of this sheer amount. But on the other side of it, it makes it a little easier because of the digital age also to find an audience that would love Wildlike that may, without social networks or, you know, Kickstarter or Indiegogo, these types of crowdsourcing things, makes it a little, having those things makes it easier to connect directly with somebody who, for instance, loves Alaska. Or Alaska, the 14, 15 people that live in Alaska, for instance. I'm almost sure they're going to
all
see.
They all worked on the movie.
That's right. They're
half the
crew.
They've seen the movie, right, in real life.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying, though?
But it's different than Hollywood. To access the people you think you want to, quote, unquote, target.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think you can get lured into a sense of trying to find a very specific audience when, you know, sort of honing in on a really small demographic that seemed to be responding. When you might be better off to just show it to more and more people and let it find its own its own level of interest. It's hard because it all costs money and it all costs.
Well, that's the thing, you guys.
Do.
I don't know about your marketing budget, but I'm guess it's not.
Zero.
It's going to be as right.
There's nothing.
Precisely. So I imagine a film like Flight, for instance, or what was the one? Spectral. Spectral.
They spend as much on the marketing as they do on the movie.
Yeah, exactly. So therefore, when you plaster posters up and all over the buses and subways, you're gonna and on TV, obviously, you're gonna find an audience by default. You know, you're gonna get a certain number. So
yeah, we could buy a poster,
right?
And we'd have to drive it around on the back of an Econoline van.
All right.
You know, and try and find crowded streets.
Sure.
You know, so yeah. So here we are at festivals,
yes,
hoping that a handful of people will see it and begin talking about it.
Sure, get the buzz going. Bruce, thanks so much.
You're welcome, sure, Adam. Yeah,
really nice meeting you. And we'll.
The other movie is a movie called Elephant Song. That was at the Hamptons also and at TIFF.
Oh, so you really were busy. Oh, you were up at TIFF too?
No, I was working on Spectral at the time in Budapest, but I haven't been home since end of June.
Really?
Yeah, I went home for 48 hours to pack a set of bags, and now I'm not going to be home again until end of November.
Part of the...
it's just part of the itinerant life of an actor, you know?
Yeah, sure. The vagabond, the gypsy, as it were, right? Do you have children or grown?
No, it's on the internet. We have my wife and I have a daughter who I think is 17. I'm not sure what her name is. It might be Cindy. However, that's
what are you saying?
Well, apparently the two of us had a child without knowing it.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
As far as
we did a great job raising her, and I'm eventually she'll show up, I guess. Yeah, but that's the kind of thing you just kind of go, well, you know what? If there's some falsehoods out there, fine.
Yeah,
you know,
whatever.
Let them go for it. Because I just as soon have a bunch of nonsense out there as I would my real life.
Right.
You know, that's why I have a hard time thinking about Twitter. You know,
I get it.
I think I probably should, because then it would be a way for me to connect with, you know,
well,
400 people that have seen this movie in the last week and go,
well, yeah,
hey, what did you think?
Yeah, you know? But those 400 have. Oh, that's
exactly,
kind of
the
in lieu of the marketing budget.
That's the argument for doing it, but I'm a little loath to have to come up with something clever every 45 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
Or be revealed to not have something
clever. I'm
trying
clever to come up with
something.
Oh,
do you do that?
45 days. Tweet.
Yeah. You have a follower?
I have 1,000 followers, which is, I understand, like nothing. By the way, if you're listening and you are one, I appreciate it. But very much, actually. Truthfully, I'm always like just no. I mean, anybody's interested in what I'm doing, I'm honored.
Flattered, yeah.
See, I really am flattered. I mean, like goodness, but you know, when somebody's got like 2 million, I don't. It's all ridiculous. Anyway, everybody agrees with that, right? It's all ridiculous. A lot of this.
It seems ridiculous to people of my age, but it isn't ridiculous. It's just it is what it is, and it's
right.
a tremendously
it is.
Effective way.
Right.
To,
it's a powerful tool,
and,
but it's but the idea of like you know the knowing your number of this or that is a little bit superficial. I guess.
Well, I mean, you know, there's ways where you can still be amusing and pointed and have a point of view without saying. You know, here's my address and here's my phone number and, you know, this is where my kids go to school.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, yes.
You don't have to do that.
Well, I hope that our paths cross again soon.
Yeah, and likewise. And, thanks,
know,
Adam.
It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, cheers, man. My name is Bruce Greenwood. You're listening to Film Wax Radio with Adam Shardoff. And today we're going to be talking about Wildlike, a film we've got coming out hopefully this year. That has stars me and a young girl named Ella Purnell, who's a wonderful English actress. It takes place in basically Denali National Park, where we walk all through Alaska, trying to evade our own demons and eventually to almost come to terms with them. But it's a really beautiful story, and maybe we'll tell you a little bit more about it during this conversation with Adam.
Thank you.
It's a bit of a long introduction. I guess,
well, I was thinking of just an ID thing where you just say, you know, where I would stick it in occasionally into, but that's great.
I'll just do an ID.
Yeah.
Film Wax.
Film Wax Radio. Yeah. And by the way, I'm actually glad you did bring her up. Elle, is her name is?
Ella Purnell.
Ella, because I didn't really talk about her very much, and she was extraordinary. She was a really talented young lady.
She's super talented.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And obviously got an amazing career ahead of her, so.
Well, she's also one of those people who's endowed with a face that the camera just cannot get enough of, you know.
Right.
And she's got a real sense of herself, and she can be very internal. And she's a young person who's really capable of internalizing virtually everything, and it makes it really compelling to watch.
I'll manage to edit that into the show, just the way you just described her.
Thank you.
hope you enjoyed it. I certainly had a thrill last year when I did it. I've been sitting on this show for a really long time, and I'm glad that the film is now out there for your enjoyment. You know, I can't say enough about it. So, again, the movie's called Wildlike. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm having Adam McGoyan on the show coming up. And what a thrill that is, because I'm just like an enormous fan. Also on the next show, we're welcoming back A. DiCalvo, who directed The Missing Girl. You remember, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that I've been following this film since I was on the set last summer, called The Missing Girl, which starred Robert Longstreet. It's directed by A. DiCalvo and produced by Mike Ryan. And it stars also Robert Longstreet, Alexi Rasmussen, Thomas J. Ryan, and a host of other people. And most of these people have been on the show. And so now we're going to bring A. DiCalvo back onto the show to talk about the festivals. Because we talked about the production of the film. Now we're in the festival circuit. He had his big world premiere at TIFF, which is huge. And now he's going to be at Woodstock. And he also just recently did, I think, Fantastic Fest. And he's going into a bunch of other festivals. It's an amazing story. So we're going to go into a conversation with A. DiCalvo on the next show as well. And who else is coming up on the show? We've got the cinematographer Tim Orr, who works with David Gordon Green on every film, I think, basically going all the way back to George Washington, right up through the new film. We have an episode coming up soon with Guy Madden, like Adam McGoyan, a Canadian and a terrific filmmaker. I mean, you know, he's incredible. He's an incredible guy. And we have a conversation coming up very shortly with Michael Schultz, who directed, among other films, he's directed Car Wash and Coolie High, Which Way Is Up. So he had a bunch of collaborations with Richard Pryor, and then is now directing lots of TV, but he's got an incredible career, and he was a great interview. So, and of course, much, much more. Thank you, everybody, for supporting the show. Go to iTunes, and if you're not currently a subscriber, you can subscribe there. Go to iTunes, search under in the search field for Film Wax Radio, and then like the show and subscribe. Just give a star rating. Please leave a comment, all that stuff. It helps so much. Like our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/filmwaxradio. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Instagram. We're around. Filmwaxradio.com. You can send us a message right off the website there. I will read it. I will get back to you. I do all the time. If you have written me and you have not heard back from me, write me again, please, and remind me, and I apologize. And people write me. Why would they write me? Well, but they want me to see their films. They want me to interview people. You know, I'm not always able to do it, but I tell you what. I want to be your friend. I want to get to know you. If you're creative, if you're in it, if you're serious, I will be there. You know, what more can I say? So we're heading into the New York Film Festival in a few days. We're going to Woodstock Film Festival. We're going to go to the Hamptons Film Festival. So it's a little bit of a busy period. Lots of great films coming up, including, too many to mention here, but I will get to them next week. Okay, we'll talk about it on the next episode in more detail, but I'm going to leave you here. Thank you for listening to episode number 314 of Film Wax Radio. My name is Adam Shartoff. The name of the show, again, is Film Wax Radio. Until next time, take care. Estábamos los dos mirando el mar. Cuando la tarde moría, como moría lo nuestro, juro que no lo sabía. Miré para mi derecha, vi que desaparecías, grité con todas mis fuerzas. Y noté que no me oí.